I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. After an almost two-year investigation that included interviews with some 500 witnesses, nearly 500 search warrants, more than 2,800 subpoenas, and 34 indictments, including 7 convictions, Special Counsel Robert Mueller sent his much-anticipated report to Attorney General William Barr on Friday. On Sunday, Barr released a 4-page summary of Mueller's findings written in consultation with Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein. In a nutshell, Barr said that Mueller did not find collusion between the Trump campaign and the Russian government. On questions about Trump and obstruction of justice, Barr quoted Mueller. While this report does not conclude that the president committed a crime, it also does not exonerate him. Barr wrote that he and Rosenstein, having read the report, determined that President Trump's actions were not criminal. There now calls for Barr to release the entire report because of so many unanswered questions. We asked Josh Gerstein to join us, and he's senior legal affairs contributor to Politico and has covered the Mueller investigation. Josh, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Hey, Marty, good to be with you again.
Nice to have you with us. And to our listeners, any questions or comments, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times if you have any questions for our guests. Josh, we're talking about Barr's interpretation of Mueller's report. Is Mueller talking?
He hasn't spoken yet, and of course he was famously sort of taciturn through this whole investigation over the last 2 years. Not only wasn't he really heard from, he was barely seen in public. It's almost comical in sort of Washington press circles that there's only really a couple clips of video and a couple photos of him from the last 2 years to illustrate Lord knows how many stories that have been written during that time. So I think we may hear from him in a formal setting on Capitol Hill. I don't think he's going to be sitting down for news interviews anytime soon.
Let's go back almost 2 years, then, looking at what Mueller was charged in doing. And I ask that only because I think there's so many moving parts, and it's easy to kind of lose track of the various storylines. What was Mueller's charge?
Well, there was a public charge and a private charge, and the public charge was essentially to figure out whether there were any ties or collusion in the common vernacular between the Trump campaign and the Russian government, and then also to look at broader issues of Russian interference in the 2016 election. That was the way the investigation was publicly framed by Rod Rosenstein when, as acting attorney general following Jeff Sessions' recusal, he named Mueller back in May of 2017. The sort of more detailed charge to Mueller, actually, we don't know precisely what the outer bounds or outer contours were of Mueller's investigation. We know, obviously, he was looking at the Trump campaign. He was looking at whether there was obstruction by the president or other people in his orbit of efforts to get to the bottom of what happened with Russia in 2016. And we know, obviously, that certain issues related to the former chairman of the Trump campaign, Paul Manafort, which led to him being prosecuted in two different courts, were deemed to be within the scope of Mueller's investigation. Mm. But there were some other matters that we still don't know exactly how things were parceled out, what he was allowed to investigate, and what was deemed to be appropriate to hand off to other federal prosecutors.
Well, let me pick up on the collusion part, and I guess there are very coordination or ties between the Trump campaign and the Russian government. Is it important to separate out the government from oligarchs or from hackers trying to get into people's email accounts?
I mean, it did cover both those things, because we know that there were some charges that Mueller filed surrounding sort of trolls and other people from Russia who are allegedly involved in efforts to interfere in the 2016 campaign. So Mueller did consider that, or the Justice Department decided that was in his orbit. But I don't remember in those cases them making a specific charge that it was the Russian government. It was sort of implied. One of the figures who was charged in one of the cases is a gentleman who's known as Putin's chef, because he ran restaurants and so forth that were favored by Russian President Vladimir Putin. But in the criminal charges, I don't remember seeing specific allegations on the trolling side. Now, when it comes to the hacking issue of hacking into Democratic emails, there they did specifically charge Russian intelligence agents, Russian intelligence officers with being behind those efforts. Now, whether that's all true is, you know, open to interpretation. There's yet to be a trial on any of those matters because, as you can imagine, the Russians involved, at least the individuals, are not particularly interested in presenting themselves to appear in a U.S. court.
So according to Barr, Mueller concluded that there was no, quote unquote, collusion. I think what's hard for the public, and I will speak for the public here, is to understand the Russian meeting in Trump Tower, the fact that Flynn and Jared Kushner wanted backdoor channels to be able to talk with Russians. There were apparently something like 100 meetings between campaign officials or transition team officials and Russian operatives. What was the criteria then that Mueller was using so that these public statements are, I guess, in one category and what he was looking at in another category?
Yeah, so there's a footnote in this four-page letter that Barr put out on Sunday that sort of addresses this issue. And the standard Mueller used was really not any exchange of information or any dialogue or any contact between people involved in the campaign and Russia. It's probably worth saying that it's not uncommon for foreign countries or representatives of foreign countries or foreign nationals to have some level of contacts with campaigns. They're always sort of interested in knowing who might be elected and what kinds of policy positions they're taking. But when Mueller was looking at his investigation and the potential charges here, he sort of narrowed his focus to what he called coordination with the Russians, which would mean more than just meeting with them, but having what he called a tacit or express agreement between the Trump campaign and the Russian government to interfere in the election. And that's where he said that he was not able to establish from the evidence that there was that kind of explicit agreement between the Trump campaign and Russia.
Let's talk about what, and again, it's what Barr says and Mueller says, but going to this question about the president and obstruction of justice, while this report does not conclude that the president committed a crime, it also does not exonerate him. Now, the president answered some questions from the Mueller team, but he was not questioned directly by Mueller. How come?
Well, there was kind of a complex dance here between Mueller's team and President Trump's lawyers. And there was a fair amount of second guessing going on at this point with people saying, well, maybe the president should have been questioned directly. His lawyers were reluctant to have him do that. They said that they felt that it was what they referred to as a perjury trap, which was basically, in their view, that Mueller was going to try to ask him questions that were designed to elicit a false response or to ask him so many questions that some of the answers might not be accurate, and then he would be in trouble simply for what he had said in that interview, even if Mueller couldn't find any separate crime to charge him with. So there were negotiations back and forth. The president would have had a couple different privileges that he could have raised to prevent himself from being subpoenaed to testify in front of the grand jury. He could have sought to assert some form of executive privilege. And he also, frankly, could have asserted the more basic privilege that any American has, which is to take his exercise his Fifth Amendment right to remain silent. Now, that might have been politically awkward or embarrassing, but if there were actually a subpoena, he would have been able to do that. And whether that would have been politically damaging the president, I think it's hard to say, given the way he has painted the whole investigation as a witch hunt. It might have simply just fueled his complaints about Mueller and what he liked to call his team of killers, what the president would refer to as his team of killers, being Mueller's more junior prosecutors.
Team of killers, kind of incendiary language there, I would say. Now, Barr wrote, this was a 19-page memo last summer where he raised some pretty serious questions, and I'll just quote a couple of sentences from that. He said, Mueller should not be permitted to demand that the president submit to interrogation about alleged obstruction, basically saying that Mueller's obstruction theory is fatally conceived. He also goes on to say it would do lasting damage to the presidency and to the administration of law within the executive branch. Understanding that, according to Barr, Barr and Rosenstein saying that the president did not obstruct justice, does this memo written last summer, does that raise some questions?
Yeah, I mean, it does raise questions about whether Barr came into this with sort of a preordained or preconceived notion that the president, regardless of the facts, couldn't be guilty of obstruction of justice. Now, I think Barr has said that his memo and the opinions he issued, A, that he acknowledged at the time that he didn't have complete information. He was basically working from the public record. And I think most of his concerns were oriented around this issue that, frankly, a number of legal scholars have raised, as whether the president simply by firing Jim Comey, that itself could have constituted obstruction of justice. The president's advocates and supporters and some other folks have said that they don't think that acts that a president, you know, squarely has within his or her constitutional powers, like firing an FBI director, could be the kind of thing that gives rise to the charge of obstruction of justice. Many other scholars say it could be, and that there's many situations where a legitimate act taken for an illegitimate reason could result in obstruction of justice. And frankly, it's hard to tell, Marty, when I read Barr's letter, whether he's approaching this through the same frame of that 19-page missive that he sent some time ago, or whether there's other factors involved. It seemed to me that he probably deliberately tried to steer away from some of the analysis that he put forward there, for, you know, out of this very fear that people would say, well, this is just a rubber stamping of an opinion you already issued.
Well, you can't answer this, Josh, because we don't have the full report. But it is interesting that Mueller essentially did not come to a conclusion himself about obstruction of justice. Does that tell us anything?
Well, we don't know exactly why. I mean, that's the thing that we are all eager to find out. And one possibility is, you know, there's this longstanding policy of the Justice Department that dates back a couple decades, or really maybe as many as four decades, saying that the Justice Department will not even consider bringing criminal charges against a sitting president. And so it's possible that Mueller took a look at that policy and said, look, it really doesn't matter that much whether we say that Trump committed a crime or didn't commit a crime if we don't have any intent to charge him, and so that maybe it's not our proper role to do anything other than lay out the evidence on both sides. And the letter from Barr does say that when it comes to these specific issues of obstruction, that there were facts and evidence on both sides of each incident that that the special counsel and his staff analyze. So when we do see the full report, we're expecting to see information that they think is, you know, indicative that Trump might be guilty of some of these offenses, and paired up with other things that prosecutors decided might excuse his conduct in these specific instances, which they don't lay out in the letter exactly how many episodes Mueller looked at. We're assuming,
you know,
it
Josh,
would include issues like,
I got to jump in here only because we need to take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's Josh Gerstein, senior legal affairs contributor to Politico, walking us through the Barr letter that was released on Sunday. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about what Attorney General William Barr concluded from the investigation that Special Counsel Robert Mueller did into allegations of Russian meddling in the 2016 presidential election. On Sunday, Barr released about a four-page summary saying there was no evidence the Trump campaign colluded with Russia. And on the president and obstruction of justice, a much more mixed message, although Barr did conclude that he did not believe that the president broke the law. Politico's Josh Gerstein is filling us in. And in a couple of minutes, we'll be talking about an interesting Supreme Court ruling from Connecticut that could open gun manufacturers to lawsuits. And again, you can join our conversation, 1-888-477-9499, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Josh, you mentioned right before the break about wanting access to the full report. It seems that most of us want that just so that we know what it is that we are talking about. Do you think that will happen?
I think it will probably happen eventually, but there may be a couple stages before that. The Justice Department has said that they're going to begin. They've already begun looking at the report, going through it. looking in particular for grand jury information, which is supposed to remain secret, and trying to figure out if they can weed that out of the report. There are also other issues they're going to have to confront about issues of privacy regarding some of the people that were investigated, and also issues, and this might be some of the most intriguing parts of the report, of ongoing investigations. We know, and I mentioned earlier, about other investigations spawned or spun off by the Mueller probe, and if those are ongoing, as a general rule, the Justice Department would not discuss them publicly. So that review is underway, and we're thinking that in a period of some weeks or maybe a couple months, the rest of the report will be presented to Congress in some form. Whether the whole thing comes out, I think, is possibly a factor of how hard the House wants to press to receive it. If they really want to do something like issue a subpoena in connection with an impeachment inquiry, at that point it would be very, very difficult, I think, legally for the Justice Department to hold this back.
I'm wondering, though, even not including impeachment, but whether House committees would hold hearings just on talking to either Barr or maybe even Mueller about what exactly this report is about.
Well, Marty, I think as soon as a couple weeks from now, we can expect to see Attorney General Barr up on Capitol Hill. It's not formally scheduled yet, I don't think, but traditionally towards the beginning of the year, we see the Attorney General on Capitol Hill to discuss the Justice Department's budget. And usually those hearings become a kind of free-for-all for whatever lawmakers want to interrogate the Attorney General about. So I think Barr is looking at that happening perhaps in the second week of April. And then I do think that there will be more focused hearings relating to the Mueller issues and the Mueller report, possibly featuring Barr, possibly featuring Mueller himself at some point in the coming months.
Now, William Barr was the Attorney General for George Herbert Walker Bush. This, of course, takes us back several decades when President Bush pardoned the people involved in the Iran-Contra scandal, apparently upon the advice of William Barr. What, if anything, should we make of that?
Well, you know, there are a lot of conservative Republicans who are skeptics of the special counsel process, whether that's an independent counsel, as we had with Iran-Contra, appointed by statute, or as we have with Mueller, a special counsel within the confines of the Justice Department, but with a bit more autonomy than a typical prosecutor. And so I put Barr in that camp that tends to be skeptical of those kinds of structures. So far as I know, since Barr became Attorney General, we haven't heard any criticism of Mueller directly, but we start to see the hints of perhaps a divergence between Mueller and Barr in this letter that came out over the weekend. One is the fact that Barr and Rosenstein went ahead and reached conclusions that Mueller was not willing to reach. It would be very interesting to ask Mueller whether he agrees with that. And the second thing I'd point to is the fact that we were told by the Justice Department that this letter Barr and Rosenstein wrote was not cleared with or coordinated with Mueller. Yeah. And so he apparently didn't take part in that decision to sort of issue a clean bill of health to the president. It'll be interesting to see when he can speak publicly about this, what he says he thinks about that move. Now, they are saying they will consult with Mueller at the next stage as they consider making a larger chunk or larger portions of his report public.
The president tweeted that this is complete and total exoneration. Is that correct?
No, I don't see how you can say it's complete and total exoneration. We have a direct quote. Barr was careful, I think, to include at least a few quotes from the report, so it couldn't be said that he was completely detaching this from what Mueller found. And there's a direct quote in there saying that while they decided not to charge the president or not to accuse him of a crime, the report also does not exonerate him. So in that context, for the president or people like White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders to be saying he's been completely exonerated, I would say the jury's still out.
Well, on that note, Josh Gerstein, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times, getting us up to speed on this really important issue. Thanks so much.
Okay, Marty. Thank you. Take care.
You too. And he's senior legal affairs contributor to Politico. Well, from one legal issue to another, 1 week after a gunman killed 50 people at a mosque in New Zealand. That government changed the laws, including instituting a ban on assault weapons to go in effect in April next month. In Connecticut, the Supreme Court ruled this month that the company that made the AR-15-style Bushmaster, used by Adam Lanza in 2012 to massacre children and teachers at Sandy Hook Elementary School, could be sued. It's a case brought by Sandy Hook victims' families who cited the marketing of the firearm and is a challenge to the immunity Congress gave gun manufacturers from litigation. This legal decision is now closely watched and will have ramifications no matter the verdict. We asked John Culhane to join us. He's a professor of law, co-director of the Family Health Law and Policy Institute at Widener University, Delaware Law School. He's also a contributing writer to Politico, which is where we saw his article about this Connecticut Supreme Court ruling. And John Culhane, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks.
And to let me just add a couple of things. The very sad and tragic news that yesterday, Jeremy Richmond, the father of one of those children murdered at Sandy Hook, died yesterday, apparently of a suicide. We also have news today that officially the federal government has banned bump stocks going into effect today. And this is, of course, after the mass shooting on October 2017 in Las Vegas. 58 people were killed. So we've got these, on one hand, this tragedy. On the other hand, it looks like at least some movement to ban some of these more dangerous weapons.
Some movement. I'd have to say it's not much. And when you compare what's happened here with what's happened in New Zealand, the contrast is pretty striking. One of the things that strikes me about the suicide, and of course there were two suicides in Parkland within the last 10 days, yeah, is we think about the victims and the immediate victims, but the kind of the tragedy and the long-term effect on the survivors, you know, can go on for decades and be devastating. And it's not surprising that people are trying to find ways around this statute, which makes bringing a lawsuit, let alone winning one, extremely difficult. So maybe I can talk a little bit about the law and then sort of talk about the Connecticut court and how they found a way around it, essentially.
Yeah, let's break it down, because this is a little complicated.
It is.
And we should say, and I mentioned this in my introduction, is that there is a kind of immunity that Congress gave to gun manufacturers from litigation.
There is. So in 2005, Congress passes something called the Protection of Legal Commerce in Arms Act. And what that does is make it extremely difficult to sue gun sellers, manufacturers, you know, distributors and retailers in connection with the sale and eventual, you know, harm caused by guns. And the reason this was passed, in addition to the power of the NRA, obviously, is that there were some lawsuits brought by cities claiming that these guns saturating the market were a public nuisance.
Chicago being one,
Newark, I think Gary, Indiana. There were several of these, and some courts were dismissing them, but some of them were starting to make it to the appellate level. And the concern was that the gun sellers don't have the same kind of deep pockets, for example, as tobacco, and there was concern that they could be bankrupted by these lawsuits. So for that reason, Congress passes this law, which essentially says that with certain very narrow exceptions, you can't sue a gun seller if the gun operates as it's supposed to operate, essentially. So what that means is you can't get at the manufacturer of the gun, even if the gun is extremely lethal, for example. And you think, well, of course a gun is lethal, but there are degrees. So
sure,
a revolver is quite different from an AR-15, right? So there are two exceptions to this, though, and this is what brings in what the Connecticut Supreme Court did. So the first exception – well, actually, there are several exceptions, but two that potentially applied – one is the idea of negligent entrustment, and the second is the Connecticut Unfair Trade Practices Act.
So negligent entrustment.
So let me talk about that. So negligent entrustment is, yeah, I'll give you sort of the Reader's Digest.
The 30-second version.
Is essentially you sold a gun to a person who shouldn't have had one, sort of like flipping your car keys to someone who's drunk. There are certain situations where a person should not have a dangerous instrument. And negligent entrustment claims are sort of bracketed and survive. The problem is they're trying to apply it here to the entire civilian population, saying what you negligently entrusted was this military-grade weapon that really should be for law enforcement and the military. And so it's a general negligent entrustment to the entire civilian population. And both the trial court and the Connecticut Supreme Court were not buying that. They said this is a radical extension of common law. The idea of negligent entrustment, it's the person directly injured. So that didn't work. The second argument, though, is more powerful, as it turns out. So like most states, Connecticut has an unfair trade practices law. And essentially it says, among other things, that anyone who's injured in any way, it can be financially, but as the court interpreted, it could be physical injury or death, by an unfair or a deceptive trade practice, can sue the person who engaged in the practice. And the argument here is a marketing argument, that they marketed this gun particularly for people like Adam Lanza, who was the shooter in Sandy Hook, basically sort of appealing to his militaristic
fantasy life.
Exactly.
Well, let me pick up on a couple of things. So what the Supreme Court then in Connecticut ruled said, they were looking at how this gun was being marketed to people.
That's right.
And that I guess the people who are suing these gun manufacturers can use that argument in court.
That's right. Although the court did say it was going to be difficult. So the first piece of the argument is, first of all, whether this law even applies. And they said that it did, because if the court said, imagine a case where it was very clear that they were marketing this specifically as a weapon of mass destruction. Mm-hmm. The court said those aren't these facts, but we can't imagine that Congress intended to exclude cases of outrageous marketing, essentially, if I can paraphrase. So the first piece of it is, did that marketing actually affect Adam Lanza in the way where he chose among different weapons, he picked the most lethal and the most militaristic? And then the second difficulty is, and did that increase the number of victims, and how would you prove that? So all the court is deciding now is that he has stated a claim. The case should go back to the trial court to make a decision about whether the facts can establish the theory that he's suing under.
Well, and I mean, here's some obvious arguments against that, which is that there are plenty of people that have this weapon and have never killed anybody with that weapon or massacred a classroom of children, for instance.
Right. But that's really not much of an argument legally, because there are lots of things. There are plenty of people who, you know, drive negligently but don't happen to get into an accident. So we sort of look at the actual consequences, mm-hmm. and say, you know, was this an increased risk? And if there's an increased risk that can be traced to the marketing, the fact that there are other people who didn't take the same action really shouldn't be an impediment.
And the marketing, I've seen some of this marketing, and it does sell this military style weapon as it has all the sort of markings of what it would be to be in the military.
Yeah, so they promoted this as the uncompromising choice when you demand a rifle as mission adaptable as you are. They talk about soldiers moving on patrol through jungles. And this is probably the most outrageous. Forces of opposition bow down. You are single-handedly outnumbered. And I think that in particular really caught the court's attention.
Well, and it does play into the fantasy. You mentioned the word fantasy. A fantasy life of, it looks like, Adam Lanza.
That's right. So we have to be really careful about making an equation between people that are mentally disturbed, of course, and violence. But in this particular case, here was a person who had this fantasy life, and apparently the weapons had been purchased by his mother, but she had quite an arsenal. And the idea is that he chose – there were swords in there and there were pistols, but he chose this weapon. And the argument is that he did that because of the marketing, because he knew it would be more lethal, and because it sort of spoke to these fantasies that he had about, you know, being in the military and taking down enemies.
Is the court saying deal with how this weapon is promoted, or are they saying this is a weapon that is a military weapon and should not be in civilian hands?
No, the second argument is kind of foreclosed by the statute. So what they really are saying is this is really about the marketing, and really what Congress intended to do was kind of rule out claims based on the lethality of the weapon itself. But the unfair trade practices really goes to, you know, sort of think of any fraudulent marketing. And that's how the court looked at this case. It might as well be, you know, selling a car that's a lemon, for example, or saying it had features that it didn't have. This is just a more extreme example. And before this case and before the passage of the congressional statute, there had been some claims about negligent marketing, which were, you know, that a manufacturer saturated the market and didn't really keep track of where the guns were going. And those were not really getting any traction, but there was some concern that they would. The argument is that this is much worse. This is not just failing to keep tabs on where your guns are going. This is actively sending them out with a message that makes it likelier that they'll be used illegally, not for self-defense, not for hunting, not for the legal purposes for which guns should be sold.
We're almost up at a break here. I mean, clearly these guns have been used in these mass shootings because of their lethality. But if you look at most murders or most crimes committed with guns, they're not these weapons.
That's right. So it depends on whether we look at mass shootings or whether we look at kind of the, you know, horrible background of shootings that go on every day. If you look at mass shootings, they do tend to be the weapon of choice, particularly in these cases where you've got 40, 50 people, massacred. So, you're not going to solve all of those problems with this lawsuit. All you're getting at is a very small piece. And as maybe I can talk about after the break, the litigation, though, could have kind of a secondary effect, which is in part what the manufacturers fear and also in part drove the federal statute's enactment.
Well, let's take that short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's John Culhane. He's a professor of law, co-director of the Family Health Law and Policy Institute. That's at Widener University Delaware Law School. He's a regular contributor to Politico. And we saw that he wrote an article recently looking at a decision by the Connecticut Supreme Court that seemed to open the doors to suing gun manufacturers for how they are promoting some of their guns. And some of their more lethal guns, I should say. Do you think gun manufacturers should be sued? Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with law professor John Culhane about whether gun manufacturers should be held accountable for things like mass shootings. And it looks like a Connecticut Supreme Court ruling has opened the door to those kinds of lawsuits. And we would love to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. From your perspective, though, John, are you looking to use, would you like this lawsuit to essentially prohibit the sale of these, you know, AR-15 style weapons, guns?
Well, there's two questions there. One is what I would like to see, and my own preference would be for legislation that would ban weapons like this. I don't think that this lawsuit, even if it's fully successful, can achieve that result. It would more be to stop the marketing practices. And so it might be that without those marketing practices, you can't sell as many of those guns. So it could have that effect. But again, this is pretty specific. And I think one reason the case will likely survive appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. It could happen if the court decides to take cert on it, which is a sort of a maybe. It could survive because they are not trying to drive the guns from the market, but just to stop unscrupulous marketing practices. And the idea that the state doesn't have the ability to do that, as the Connecticut Supreme Court said, this is kind of the only recourse when these outrageous marketing practices are taking place. And if this were any other industry, we wouldn't have a question about whether this created a private right of action. So it's not really a tort claim, because it's based in this state statute, even though the effect could be similar compensation to what you would get in the tort claim.
I'm thinking about, you know, other ways that, for instance, cars are sold. So if using this as an example, would the advertising for, let's say, a fancy car be, you can drive 250 miles an hour.
Exactly.
And you don't have to stop at red lights. And you can, I mean, that the laws essentially don't apply to you.
Well, you know those things that say, this is a professional driver,
yes,
do not attempt.
Right? Yes.
So if you take those out and then make it more outrageous, either visually, I was thinking about this example, you showed somebody driving a sedan 200 miles an hour and you said, you know, get the rush or something like that. You don't have to say much. A lot of it, a lot of the way we communicate is through these, you know, images and these visuals. And, you know, I think for a state to be powerless to stop something like this, or some entity, whether it's a federal or state level, to be powerless to stop that, which would strike us as nuts. Mm. So I think all the court is saying is if, in fact, these marketing practices are established, and if much more difficult, they can establish, the plaintiffs can establish that it made a difference in this case. Because Adam Lanz is dead, it's hard to know exactly what was going on there.
Right.
But presumably, we can then have some kind of recourse for these plaintiffs.
I wonder, too, whether there are lessons from how the government eventually dealt with tobacco companies or cigarette makers, sellers.
The lesson there is really about litigation and the course of litigation. And one of the things I mentioned on the Politico article is that once these lawsuits are allowed to go forward, what you get is the unearthing of documents, of internal correspondence, assuming it's not protected by some privilege, which right. It turns out a lot of the documents are not protected, that show, in the case of tobacco, for example, that's how we learned that the industry executives knew that nicotine was addictive. We didn't. I mean, we thought we knew that, but here we had them talking. But they knew that. Exactly. Here we had them talking about it. So similarly here, there's this possibility that I think advocates of gun control are hoping for, that even if this doesn't result in the repeal of the law, it could result sort of collaterally in the imposition of new restrictions. And for example, in the case of tobacco, in the wake of these documents coming out, we had the master settlement agreement where the states got, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars to use. There are some questions about how
for
they're using
public health
it.
And things
yeah,
like that.
They're not always using it that way, or not even a high percentage of it. But that was the idea, and it did do some good, which is ban certain kinds of marketing. If you'll remember, marketing to kids, certain restrictions on billboards. So there were, you know, collateral consequences that inure to the public's health.
Let me read a couple of comments here. One on our Facebook page from Joseph, who says, I doubt any lawsuit in any state against a gun manufacturer will be upheld by the Supreme Court. Do you share his view?
Well, if the Supreme Court were to decide the case on the merits with the composition of the current court, I think he's probably correct. I think the kind of prior question is whether the court thinks this is something they want to deal with. So what you – and it's complicated in this case, and I'll try to break it down. So the Connecticut Supreme Court is applying the Connecticut law and saying that one of the exceptions to the federal law, which is if you violate a state statute that applies, you can be held liable. And the state statute here, of course, is the Unfair Trade Practices Law. What the Supreme Court could say is that Congress didn't intend for this exception to be read so broadly. They really meant it to be used in cases where there's specific legislation about guns and not these unfair trade practices laws. Hmm. There's nothing in the statute that – in the federal statute that says that. And in fact, I was looking at the findings, and the findings talk about how they don't want – I'm talking about the findings Congress made before they passed the law. The findings say that Congress did not want to stop the lawful sale and marketing of guns. Well, if this is unlawful marketing, then I think there's an argument that at least the statute is ambiguous enough. And what the Supreme Court could say if it took the case was, you know, since this is taking away a right that would have existed at common law, we should read the exceptions narrowly, so against Congress in the sense that if they want to bar these suits, they should make that very clear.
Right. And what the we are talking about marketing. Sense, we are talking more about marketing than we are about guns.
Right. I mean, the guns are sort of the subject of the marketing, and they would be affected, but kind of as a secondary thing.
Let me read a tweet from Jamie who says, my husband is in law enforcement. We are gun owners who believe in gun control. We also believe gun manufacturers should not be responsible. That would be like making car manufacturers responsible for car accidents. And I raised that earlier, which is that most people, I'm sure our listener here, who have guns are not misusing them or using them for criminal purposes.
Right. And it's a powerful analogy, but I think sometimes people draw the wrong conclusions from it, because we think about things that are deadly. You know, automobiles come right to the fore. So let's compare a couple of cases. In one case, you might have somebody who is, you know, simply out there driving recklessly, or, you know, trying to mow people down, or is reckless because they're drunk or something along those lines. And if the car causes an injury or fatality in that case, unless I knew a lot more, nobody would say that the car manufacturer should be liable for that. It's a different thing, as we've said earlier, if the manufacturer is marketing and selling the gun as – I'm sorry, the car as able to go 250 miles an hour and they show somebody on a speedway and people sort of take that and run with it. You know, these marketing – we know the reason firms hire advertising agencies, right, and marketing firms is that marketing works. We know this. And – there's a reason why all of this thought and money was spent on the marketing campaign for this particular weapon. So, you know, just like any other consumer product.
Well, and consumer products, broadly speaking, do sell oftentimes, you know, a fantasy of good health, of adventure, of beauty, all of that.
Exactly. So, I'm still waiting. But yeah, so right.
But I'm just saying part of advertising is to promote something.
It's an image, right? You're trying to speak to a lifestyle or an image. And in most cases, that's, you know, benign enough. We could argue about whether it is. But in a case like this, if these allegations really are true, the Connecticut Supreme Court really expressed a certain kind of outrage toward the end of its decision that if these allegations are true and if this marketing really is as outrageous as suggested and if it led to the consequences, big question to be determined, then why shouldn't we have accountability in a case like that?
One of the reasons we wanted to do the show is of what New Zealand did in response to the mass shooting at the mosque last week. And I mentioned a couple of things that they have done, including banning assault weapons, but other buybacks and other things as well.
Australia, too, for that matter.
Exactly.
Right?
After a
1996 mass shooting, they immediately banned assault weapons, and they had a very successful buyback program. And they've had exactly one mass shooting since then, which happened last year.
America is not New Zealand or Australia, as we know.
This is true.
How do you see – I mean, they don't have a Second Amendment with all the things that come with it. Do you think that's the difference, or is it more than that?
Well, I think the Second Amendment, the fact that we have a Second Amendment, kind of reflects the view of guns that have been held since the founding. So I don't think you can separate out those two. And it really is – we do have a gun culture. For example, in the U.S., for every 100 people, there are 120 guns.
Yeah.
The next closest country, I think, is Yemen with like a 1-to-1 ratio. And then it drops pretty precipitously. So, you know, Americans like this person who tweeted in love their guns. And there are people who are responsible gun owners. And the way you have to pitch this, if you're going to get any progress, is not about responsible gun ownership, but is about things that really great majorities of Americans agree with, like background checks, which are only held in certain kinds of cases and not at gun shows, not in the secondary market, et cetera, et cetera. That's just an obvious one that has something like 90% support. So I think the trick is to translate that support into something that can break through the, you know, sclerotic Congress when it comes to gun legislation. The only thing we had that was successful, or that was substantial, we can argue about whether it was successful, is the assault weapons ban, but that expired of its own accord. It was not renewed.
So, and there were a lot of workarounds.
Yes.
We should add that the House of Representatives passed the, quote, Bipartisan Background Check Act of 2019. So there is some movement on that front. And again, as of today, a federal ban on bump stocks goes into effect. This is a response to the mass shooting October 2017. It was in Las Vegas. A man essentially killed 58 people and wounded many, many more. A bump stock allows a firearm essentially to act like an automatic weapon.
That's right. That's right. And as I understand it, there's already a lawsuit that's being fired up in response to this ban. And the argument is usually around the Second Amendment. And the Supreme Court has been sort of coy up until now about how broad a right the Second Amendment confers. We know from a couple of cases about 20 years ago or so that there is a right to own a gun for self-defense.
That's Scalia, right?
That's right. That's
the
Heller decision. Very good. It's a major decision where the court holds 5-4 that the Washington statute that prohibited people from owning guns for self-defense was unconstitutional. But he said, but there's plenty of room for regulation, and the Supreme Court has really kind of stayed away from guns. And that's one reason I think they might not take this case. Mm-hmm. Justice Thomas, in particular, has called the Second Amendment an orphan and says that we should be taking these cases. If this were abortion or if this were First Amendment issues, we would have taken several cases by now. But I think the court has made a quasi-political decision to kind of let states and to some extent Congress, to the extent it will do anything, sort of take the lead on this.
But I wonder whether there isn't movement or some kind of action more on the state level, thinking of Connecticut, other states as well, where maybe the federal government isn't doing what people want, but on the state level there is some action.
There's action in both directions, though. So you've got states, sort of the blue states, if I can oversimplify this, which are making it more difficult or supposedly impossible to get these assault weapons. Of course, people can bring them from other states, but it does impose a hurdle. It does impose a difficulty. And then in some of the red states, saying things like, well, you can carry a concealed weapon without a permit is a recent law from one state, which I think maybe Florida, but I could be wrong about that. But so you have movement in both directions. And because the market for guns is, at least to some extent, national, you know, it is one of our, I don't know, hallmarks that we have these, you know, laboratories of federalism where states do different things. But when it comes to something like guns, you kind of need some kind of national response, I think.
Ronnie called into the show and said, I was at a gun show last week and did have to undergo a background check.
Oh, that's great. So that could be pursuant to state law, I would imagine.
We're almost out of time here. You wrote an article a couple of years ago in the New York Times that there should be some kind of a gun tax paid by the manufacturer or the importer.
Yes. So the argument, I co-wrote this with Lucinda Finley, who's a professor at Buffalo, and we made the argument that particularly for these mass shootings, there's no recourse. There's no compensation. Let's face it, you're not going to get compensation from the shooter in the vast majority of cases. Either they're dead or they're penniless or both. And so our argument was that these have real consequences, and a compensation fund like we had for 9/11, like we have for coal miners, like we have for people injured by vaccines that have side effects to us, this case was much more compelling because there's the public health benefit of vaccines makes compensation really a no-brainer. Here, people on either side can argue about whether guns further or impede public health. But in any case, there should be some kind of way of compensating those people.
Well, we are going to end on that note. John Culhane, thanks for joining us today. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Pleasure to have you back. Professor of Law, co-director of the Family Health Law and Policy Institute. That's at Widener University, Delaware Law School. And again, a contributing writer to Politico. And we will post his article that we saw from Politico on our Facebook page. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. And you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. We always want to hear from you. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen, with help today from Susan Greenbaum. I'm Artie Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.